argument now in the case of NLRB against Deutsche Post Global Mail.
Good morning, Michael Scodro on behalf of...
Hold on for just a second until we manage to complete the change and the courtroom settles down. Mr. Scodro.
Good morning. My name is Michael Scodro, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Deutsche Post Global Mail. The NLRB in this case asked this court to enforce an order directing the respondent to recognize and bargain with a union improperly selected by a minority of the affected employees. The union sought an election at a time when Yellowstone International Mailing, which is now part of Deutsche Post Global Mail, was preparing to move to a new facility three times the size of its existing plant, to triple the size of its workforce, and to cease to exist as a distinct legal entity and become part of Deutsche Post. Not surprisingly, Yellowstone, under these circumstances, opposed the election as premature, and the NLRB's regional director agreed. As the director recognized, deciding this case requires no more than a straightforward application of the board's 1973 decision in Cooper International.
What actually happened? Was it a tsunami, as Deutsche Post predicted, or was it just a little bit of surf, as the NLRB expected?
In terms of the number of employees who failed to move to the new facility?
Yeah.
In honesty, Your Honor, I don't know. It's not in the record, and I am personally unaware of how many.
Why isn't it in the record? The board gave an opportunity after the election, but by the time the representation proceeding was contested, it ought to have been possible to put in the record what actually happened. Doesn't it seem a little odd to you that we are sitting here trying to determine what the labor board should have predicted 2 years ago rather than just figuring out what happened?
Your Honor, granted, in the AAA case, for example, it presents a separate model. In that case, unlike what you're suggesting, though somewhere in the middle, I guess, the board ordered an election, but then impounded the ballots until after the move and made a concrete determination following the move that there had, in fact, been a substantial and representative complement voting. In this case, Your Honor, the hearing before the hearing administrator took place on August 1st, well before the move. The board had issued its decision on appeal in late September, again before the move, and I'm personally unaware of why or if the record could have been expanded beyond that.
The bargaining order came after the move, did it not?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And of course, the board pointedly observed that the record had not been expanded, and therefore it had no reason to depart from its decision at the representation stage. Now, one might infer from the fact that the employer, which could have expanded the record, chose not to do it, one might infer that the board's prediction proved to be accurate.
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know, in fact, how many employees moved. But I think that as far as creating a going-forward rule, what Cooper did was establish that at the time of the hearing, there has to be three factors are present. Then it is they conduct a balancing analysis under the substantial and representative complement test, and they reach a conclusion. And that conclusion is that under that test, if these three circumstances are present, the balance comes in favor of waiting the short period until the move takes place. And those three circumstances on the uncontested record in this case are very much present. There was an imminent move. The employer proved that by submitting a negotiated lease agreement before the hearing administrator. The employer had yet to offer its existing and incumbent employees positions at the new plant. And
I thought it was expected that all the employees were going to be offered and that actually did happen.
Your Honor, in both Cooper and in this case, the employer both expected to give all of its incumbent employees offers for the new facility but had yet to do so.
But they did here, didn't they?
I'm sorry?
Didn't they do that here?
As in Cooper, in here, they did not. They, at the time of the hearing, they had yet to give the offers, but they did represent that they fully intended, as in Cooper, to give all of their current employees.
Did they follow through in that intention? Maybe that's part of Judge Easterbrook's question about what the record
might
show here.
I will confess I'm not certain, because again, the record was created before any offers were given. But they made it quite clear on the record, and we certainly don't contest that the employer was fully intending to give all 113 production employees offers for work at the new facility.
What was the distance between these
Your Honor, the record indicates the distance was about a mile and a half between the two facilities.
It's pretty likely that somebody who's working there is going to move a mile and a half instead of, you know, to another state or something like that, right?
Your Honor, again, under the limited circumstances here where the move is so imminent, I mean, a move, absolutely granted, one of the aspects that's disruptive about a move is the distance itself. Another aspect would be the transportation available between the two, something that I don't believe is in the record here. But there are other issues that go and other sources of disruption when there's a move in plants. In this case, as a concrete example, while the job classifications wouldn't change from one to the other, what would change is the type of work skills that were emphasized. There were some additional skills, such as computer entry, that would be favored at the new plant. It would be a plant three times the size. All sorts of things can happen in a move and all sorts of reasons. There can be all sorts of reasons in a move for employees not to accept positions at the new plant. The board in Cooper recognized that. And Your Honor, the NLRB is perfectly free to distinguish Cooper or to overrule Cooper if it does so in a rational way. What it has done here, like this court's decision in Indianapolis Mac, in which the board there too had tried to distinguish one of its pre-existing precedents, but did so in an illogical way, this court said, we look at those cases very, very carefully. We apply searching scrutiny to those cases when there's an allegation the board departs from its own rules. And there as here, this court found that the board had in fact departed on a basis that was not available to it. The earlier rule was broader than that, and the board was free to overrule its pre-existing rule, as it was free to do so here, provided it acknowledged that it was doing so and provided rational reasons for doing it. What happened here simply wasn't reasoned administrative decision-making. Now, Your Honor, on top of the fact that the board was unreasonable in its failure to properly address Cooper or to properly distinguish Cooper, even beyond that, it misapplies the substantial and representative complement test. Even if you don't read Cooper to apply a strict rule that under the narrow circumstances presented here, you ought to wait until after the move to hold the election, even if you don't read Cooper that strictly, the board here still provided an unreasoned decision when it applied the substantial and representative complement test. It began by applying a strict 30% rule, that there must be 30% the incumbent employees that will work at the new facility must be 30% of the ultimate full complement. And Your Honor, what they did here is that 30% rule is supported, as we point out in our briefs, by two decisions, neither one of which stand for that proposition. It then applies it strictly in a case where there's rank speculation as to how many employees will appear at the new facility. And even doing so, it comes very close to the 30% rule, which, as we argue in our briefs, is too low under existing precedent. It comes close to that number at 38%, but they say that's fine, even though they've taken a number of speculative leaps, they uphold the move. If the panel has no questions, I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Scoger. Ms. Ball.
May it please the Court, I'm Kira Voll. I represent the National Labor Relations Board in this matter. When a board makes an elected and timing decision in a case with an expanding unit, it has to balance two important policy goals relating to employees' rights with respect to choosing their representative. The first important goal is to ensure prompt election, and the second to ensure maximum employee participation in the election. In this case, the board's decision to order an immediate election was a reasonable one in light of these goals. The board found that the existing unit...
Of course, the ordering of the immediate election has led to a two-year-plus delay in bargaining. If the board had waited 6 months to hold the election, bargaining would have begun immediately. Doesn't this look like your classic case of haste makes waste?
Well, given how the case has unfolded, I can see why Your Honor might think that, but the only reason that we have delay here is because the company has refused to recognize...
Well, but the company had telegraphed that, and here we are. The board's insistence on moving forward instantly has meant, I would say, a two-year and counting delay in any effective representation of the workers.
I think there's a couple responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, the company did project its wish that the election be delayed, but that didn't necessarily mean that once the election, once the board had heard its objections, once the board had decided to order an immediate election, that the company would necessarily, in the face of the union's overwhelming win, decide not to recognize the union.
Since it's the only way to get judicial review of the election order is to refuse to bargain and wait for the bargaining order, it does seem a fair prediction. If they say we don't like the election order, they legally have to do this in order to get review.
Certainly that's the case. But I think that there's also no guarantee that had the board waited, for example, 6 months, that this election would have gone forward immediately and that the company would have immediately recognized the union either. The company's projections, you know, any company's projections of its expansion plans, I assume would be sincere when represented at the hearing, but business exigencies can change, plans can change. The company may say at the time of the hearing, we think that we'll have a certain number of expansion in 5 months, we'll move in 1 month. These things may or may not happen, and the election can be put off more and more. The Supreme Court has recognized that employees have a right to choose their representative, that it's an important consideration that this election happen quickly. The board, to put off the election because the company might object and might, you know, the company in 6 months could also still pursue its avenues of appeals and, you know, put it off further. So certainly whether or not the company is going to object, going to delay, hasn't been recognized as a factor in setting the election, I think, appropriately. As I was saying, this was a reasonable decision in light of the facts of this case, where 38% of the ultimate projected number of employees was present in the existing unit, 71 to 75% of the interim projected number was present, and 100% of the job classifications and skills were present, therefore presumably of the work-related interests of the future. Therefore, presumably, the existing unit had similar work-related representational interests to the future projected unit. The board's decision is not inconsistent with Cooper. It's only inconsistent with Cooper if we interpret Cooper as the company would like us to. As a per se rule that whenever there's a relocation without job retention promises by the employer and employees, we simply can't speculate as to the continuity of the workforce. In Cooper, there were reasons in the record to expect that the move would have some substantial impact on the continuity of the workforce, on a material impact on the employees' ability to access their job site. The distance of the new plant, the lack of cars, the lack of public transportation. In our case, there's a 1.5-mile move, and there's not a single shred of evidence in the record that there would be any substantial change in the employees' terms and conditions of employment in their access to the plant. Therefore, it was only common sense for the board to infer that a substantial number of the employees would retain their employment. Finally, I think that the rule suggested by the company is not good policy. It allows a company to delay elections essentially at will whenever a relocation is in the offing. The company can go through all of its plans and preparations for the move, but so long as it doesn't make official offers which aren't officially accepted, the board's hands are tied and it can't order an election. This is not a reasonable interpretation. I don't think it's a correct interpretation of Cooper, and in fact, in AAA alternators, the 11th Circuit rejected the company's, in that case, the company's efforts to interpret Cooper in this way. I think I've covered the issues in my brief. If the honors have no other questions, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Scrodro?
Your Honor, Cooper does place a set of broad rules. The end of the opinion, after setting forth the party's arguments, it says, in view of the imminence of the transfer of operations, the absence of evidence showing that the employer has as yet offered and that a considerable proportion of the unit employees have indicated that they would accept such employment, no useful purpose would be served by processing the petition at this time. With all due respect, the court did not, and the board and Cooper did not say, the employer, having made sufficient showing, or based on the employer's showing in this case, we set forth the following rule. Rather, the board in Cooper disregarded the employer's allegations and set forth what is a broad standard. And, Your Honor, AAA is not inconsistent. In fact, AAA is a perfect example of avoiding speculation in the manner Cooper demands. And AAA, based on a certain series of events that were simply fortuitous, they ended up having the election as the board was granting review of the regional director's decision. The board, therefore, impounded the ballots, and only after the move had taken place, and they knew for certain that, in fact, there had been a substantial and representative complement at the original plant, did the board allow those ballots to be unsealed and counted. That is the perfect example of what Cooper contemplates, certainty when there's a plant move in the offing. Finally, I'd like to just briefly address Your Honor's point, your question about extra record evidence and increasing the record. What Cooper does is set a rule so that employers, unions, know what they're doing in advance. It sets a rule about what evidence is necessary at the time of the hearing. And that's all anybody knows at that point when they're making their decision. And what Cooper does is say at that time, on the record existing then, which in this case is August 1st, at that point, what do the numbers look like? What are the circumstances? And if these three factors are present, as they were in Cooper and as they are clearly here, then under those narrow circumstances, the election should wait until certainty is in place, that is, until after the move has occurred. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.